Hello and welcome to the Script Podcast. I'm Vibha Ravi, Senior Editor with Sightline, and I'm having a conversation today with the CEO and Chairman of Ratio Therapeutics, Jack Hoppin, and Chief Scientific Officer, John Babbage. Jack is a mathematician and entrepreneur with over 20 years of research and business development experience in nuclear medicine. He previously co-founded InVicro, and the company was sold to Konica Minolta in 2017. The same year, John founded Noria Therapeutics, and Jack joined the company later. John brings to Ratio a deep expertise in radiopharma, having brought 6 products to the clinic at Molecular Insight Pharmaceuticals, which also he founded. Ratio Therapeutics is a product of collaboration between former team members at Noria. Now let's talk a bit about the field. Targeted radiopharmaceuticals, which combine cancer-seeking ligands with radioactive isotopes to deliver precision radiation, are emerging as the new frontier in oncology. With a potent and highly targeted impact, this class seems to have an advantage over other cytotoxic drugs. The modality has seen some big-ticket M&A activity, like AstraZeneca's acquisition of Fusion and Bristol-Myers Squibb's acquisition of RayzeBio. Interest in the field has undoubtedly increased after the success of Novartis's PSMA protein-targeted Pluvicto for prostate cancer. Boston-based Ratio has developed 2 R&D platforms, Trillium and Macropar, for monitoring and treating cancers. Having partnered with Bayer, Merck, and Lantheus for radiopharma imaging and drug candidates earlier, it's now independently taking forward a radiotherapeutic targeted at fibroblast activation protein, or FAP, which promotes the growth and migration of cancer cells. The company raised about $50 million recently from investors, which included BMS. Today, we will discuss not just what Ratio Therapeutics has up its sleeve, but also the latest developments and trends in radiopharmaceuticals outside the company. So welcome, Jack and John. It has been a tough funding environment for biotechs. So did the current attention on radiopharmaceuticals work in your favor, or the investors still needed convincing during the latest funding round?
Thanks, Viva. Thanks for the question. And thanks for having us on. Yes, I would say that the last couple of years have been very tough in terms of capital raise and all smaller biotech fields. Clearly, the rising tide of an opportunity in radiopharmaceuticals was helpful for us as we approached the market. A lot of the M&A occurred after we were done with our deal, so it was a long 2023, but in terms of raising our Series B, but it turned out well. I don't know if in any market investors don't need lots of convincing to get $50 million invested. So I think it was just a unique time in 2022 and 2023, but we're happy we got there, and we're very excited about our investor base.
Right. In July last year, Ratio initiated dosing in a phase 1 study for its FAP-targeted RTX-1363S for PET imaging. Could you tell us how the trial is progressing, and are there any interim findings to share?
Thank you, Viva. As you may know, the development of RTX-1363S is a collaborative agreement that we have with Lantheus Holding Company, a radiopharmaceutical company based here in Massachusetts. We did the early phase 1 imaging study in normal healthy volunteers in order to determine the safety of the product as well as the radiation dosimetry for that product. We initiated that back in May of 2023. We completed the recruitment in August of 2023 and have basically now transferred all that information over to Lantheus for them to continue the development of that program. So from a readout perspective, really it was a safety evaluation, and we saw no safety issues. And the typical for radiopharmaceutical, you have to measure and evaluate the radiation dosimetry, like for any diagnostic radiopharmaceutical. And we found a very a very good profile from that point of view. So we had a successful phase one. We transferred the IND to Lantheus, and the remainder of the development of that for clinical use is in the hands of Lantheus.
So John, does that mean that, the IP also transfers, or the IP remains with you and, further development, as in when it's commercialized, the commercialization proceeds will be shared between the two companies?
So we have a relationship, right? So it was a licensing agreement for that asset. It's specific for the diagnostic applications. And there is downstream revenue due a ratio from the development of that product from Lantheus.
Okay, thanks. You have an FAP-targeted therapeutic for an array of solid tumor cancers. Could you tell me which kind, carcinoma, sarcoma, melanoma, it's intended to treat, and what are a few likely indications?
Sure. This is a very exciting field right now in the exploration of the application of FAP across many tumors. We have not yet filed an IND for that therapeutic product. We intend to file it by the end of the year. Hopefully our goal is to file in Q4 of this year for the therapeutic. FAP is a really exciting target from the point of view of, let's call it a pan-carcinoma approach. But it's also very interesting from a specific cancer approach. FAP is expressed in activated fibroblasts, which make up a significant amount of the mass of a particular tumor, particularly in epithelial carcinomas like breast, colorectal, lung cancer. So a big portion of the mass of a tumor are activated fibroblasts, which express FAP. But in a really important way, we like to think about the target as sitting on the tumor cells. And this brings the isotope in closest proximity to the cancer itself. And in this case, sarcoma is particularly exciting as an indication, as is esophageal carcinoma and mesothelioma. Our intention is to enter the clinic in the area of soft tissue sarcoma to do our initial phase one study.
That's interesting. Ratio uses actinium-225, which has a long half-life, right? It allows for manufacturing flexibility. But a disadvantage is that relatively complex decay chain, which could have unintended consequences in the body. How is the company countering this?
Thanks for the question. Actinium is an alpha emitter. And like all alpha emitters, when you have an alpha emitter during the decay, when the radionuclide decays, you emit a helium nucleus from the atom, and then has a cascade of other alpha emitters that occur until it finally reaches, over a long period of time, a stable isotope. And so you inject actinium, it has a 10-day half-life, and when it decays, you're also generating bismuth-213, which has a 45-minute half-life. These daughter products and where they end up are studied often. It's not the easiest thing to determine, but you can try to figure out what is your translocation to the kidneys, for example, which is typically your biggest point of concern. When it comes to the safety profile of actinium, it really comes down to that with the 10-day half-life and the drugs we're working on, which have very long residence time in the tumor, it comes down to a calculation, which is what is the ratio of the absorbed dose to the tumor to the absorbed dose of your off-target organs. And this is very much a question specific to the molecule you put the actinium on. And we feel very confident, given the profile of what we've seen to date in patients with this molecule, that we have the right ratio to provide the therapeutic index such that the efficacy to the tumor greatly outweighs the off-target toxicity. But this is the point of clinical trials. That's why we have to run clinical trials to characterize and understand and monitor if there are side effects, whether they're as a result of the decay chain or just the direct biodistribution of the molecule itself outside the tumor environment. So you really want to choose your isotope based on the profile of your molecule. Ratio is agnostic to isotope selection. With Macropow, we have great actinium chelates here, and we see incredible efficacy of actinium with other molecules and other indications. So we're excited, but it's not really an emotional feeling. It's these are the calculations, and then we track the data. We have to make data-driven decisions as to the performance. There isn't any counter. We're not trying to counter in our strategy to date. We're just going to monitor it. The countering is really the profile of the drug has really good residence time. People do use other blocking agents and amino acid infusions to try to expedite renal clearance. That's something that could be considered longer term, but we start by looking at the safety profile and trying to characterize it.
Okay. I read in a research report that you also have a separate therapeutic candidate that uses lutetium, LU177. Is that right? And if yes, which stage is it in?
So this is a great question. We have, as you may know, these molecules, and when we design molecules, they have the potential to be radiolabeled with several different radionuclides, right? One of them could be lutetium, another actinium, and so on. Currently, our FAP lead candidate is in compassionate use in Europe. So we have some preliminary information based on lutetium. And the lutetium has one of the features of lutetium, although it's a beta emitter for therapeutic applications and it's used for Pluvicto and for Lutathera, is it gives off a gamma ray, which allows the distribution of the drug to be imaged in the body. And so we've had some preliminary data from Europe on the compound labeled lutetium, and I've gained tremendous insights into its behavior. And to Jack's point, being able to calculate what the ratios are from a therapeutic index perspective, whether or not we move lutetium as a therapeutic candidate through clinical trials is yet to be determined. And that will be as a function of what we see in the clinic with our actinium product.
Yeah, that's understandable. There's growing interest in the development of radiopharmaceuticals for imaging and treatment of neurological disorders such as Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. Do you see yourself exploring these areas soon?
So it's an incredibly exciting time. And over the past decade, PET imaging, namely the type of gamma radiopharmaceutical imaging we've been discussing throughout this podcast, have been key, paramount to the progression and study of those therapeutics. Both John and I have a lot of experience in that space, but that's not something that Ratio Therapeutics is pursuing. We see massive increase in interest in PET imaging driven by neurodegenerative diseases, as well as all the targeted radiotherapeutics. If we look at PSMA, the Pluvicto product from Novartis, it drove almost $1 billion in sales of the PET diagnostic in parallel because it's the gatekeeping diagnostic for the drug. And it's incredibly informative for many reasons to clinicians to do a PSMA PET scan, as well as a more standard FDG PET scan. But no, I think that our mantra here is to extend life and maintain quality and bring novel cancer therapeutics to the market and to the patient. So I think that's just too far afield. It'll be interesting longer term if there's, you know, what does integration look like in the world of radiopharmaceuticals, diagnostics, and therapeutics? It's a unique space as compared to antibody drug conjugates and LDTs with antibodies. It's a different space. We're always going to image our drug at some point. So you're always thinking about the diagnostic in conjunction. It don't have to be the same molecule, but diagnostics and therapeutics are wildly integrated in radiopharmaceuticals uniquely, but that'd be outside of our scope.
Right. Most companies are initially pursuing validated targets within radiopharma for proof of concept and then shifting to novel targets once the platforms are optimized. Earlier, I spoke about the two technological or R&D platforms that you have. So does Ratio also have a similar plan?
Yeah. So, you know, you mentioned our two platforms. One is Trillium, which we should dive into a little bit. The other one is Macropa or Macropod. Trillium is really an enabling technology in many ways. When you think about radiopharmaceutical therapy, it's not an accident that companies call Ratio Therapeutics, although in Latin it means rational or rationale. The ratio is really important. The ratio meaning how much radiation gets delivered to the tumor versus normal tissues, and that ratio really is essentially your therapeutic index, right? How much can you tolerate in terms of destruction of the tumor while maintaining a healthy, normal tissue environment? And when you think about radiopharmaceuticals, it really is the location of the actual isotope. So you can pick a vector that allows you to target a particular tumor. And we use PSMA as a perfect example. You have a tremendous expression level of PSMA in prostate cancer. And when you look at the scans, you know, in the diagnostic space of men that have gotten PSMA PET scans, you'll see tumors light up, very small tumors, large tumors. You know, it is a very powerful technique and has helped change practice. But you also see localization in off-target tissues, such as the salivary glands, some of the ligands that are used in the kidney, some retention in the kidney. You'll see some uptake in the bowel. So those off-target non-cancer tissues is something that one has to concern yourself with when you're designing a molecule. Trillium is an attempt to control the fate in vivo of that radioisotope and get as much of what is injected into the body to the tumor as possible. And we do that by hitchhiking on albumin. So we have a three-component molecule. We have the vector that attacks, in this case, say PSMA. We have a chelator that takes the radionuclide. And then we have another piece of the molecule which reversibly binds to albumin. And we can change that piece of the molecule very subtly and change the affinity to albumin also very subtly. So we can kind of titrate the residence time in the plasma. And that affects a couple of things. One is it keeps the drug in the blood so it's not rapidly diffusing out. It allows multiple passages through the tumor bed, which is typically very porous and disoriented, so it's not a high fidelity structure, so things leak into tumors. So we can sort of optimize the residence time in the plasma in order to get as much of the injected drug into the tumor. And then also by keeping it in the blood, we minimize what's going into the normal tissues. So Trillium is really an enabling platform. We build multiple scaffolds, and we can design molecules. We've done it for FAP. And the diagnostic we created for Lantheus, we've done it for the buyer relationship, and then we're in the process now of identifying, which we've now have identified a lead candidate for our phase 1 study for FAP therapeutics. And we think that this is an application that goes beyond those targets to other new targets. And we have currently 4 programs internal that have not been discussed publicly that we're optimizing the delivery of 4 new vectors to various tumors. So the application of Trillium is really where bread and butter is, although we're also very open to other technologies as it seems fit to actually design molecules to extend life with quality. So we have our own technology, we have our own chelate program, but we're also very open to using whatever means available to make the best drugs possible for patients.
Viva, I just wanted to piggyback on John very nicely describes the Trillium platform, and that's how we met. He approached me about kind of modeling or thinking through the pharmacokinetic understanding of this drug, because here it's really all about pharmacokinetics. And if we look at the drivers of pharmacokinetics, and why I think John had a brilliant idea is to try to drive and tune, make fit for purpose radiopharmaceuticals. The company strategy, looking out at known targets initially and trying to optimize and engineer better molecules for those targets. In terms of new targets in the space, we watch closely. There are some prerequisites of a targeted radiotherapeutic and working on a new target. So we're excited that newer targets have popped up in the space. It works out of how many ADC groups are turning their attention to radiopharmaceuticals, because I think the ADC landscape has done a phenomenal job of working on and characterizing, you know, targets in oncology.
Right. Jack, so I just wanted to understand, you know, when you say new targets, PSMA is an area which is crowded. It has a lot of companies having chosen PSMA as a target. Why did Ratio choose FAP? Is it because this has lesser number of companies? And which other targets would you be looking at in the future?
We chose FAP because it has a tremendous profile for a targeted radiopharmaceutical, namely highly expressed, as John nicely alluded to earlier, in many cancers, many epithelial cancers, and then also in certain cases, highly expressed not just in the stroma or cancer-associated fibroblasts of the tumor microenvironment, but also on the cancer cells themselves. If you look at the profile of FAP in FAP images, there can be target expression in certain fibroids and also in certain sites of injury. But by and large, the tumor to background signal is incredibly clean. And so we're one of many groups that have worked on this target. I think the differentiator here was building out an SAR that has long residence time. And so there were a lot of good diagnostics popped up in the market, including the one we sold to or out-licensed to Lantheus. But if you look at just the images, it is harder than if you can see it, you can kill it. But people say that a lot in this space. And there is certainly plenty of truth to it. And if you look at the ratio of the target concentration in the tumor to the off target, it's exceptionally strong in the case of FAP, as it is for somatostatin, as it is for PSMA, and the highest targeting concentration, just radioactive iodine in the thyroid. Double-digit percent of your injection goes to the thyroid, given the function of the thyroid and its requirement to use iodine. So it really comes down to that, Viva. You need the right target to off-target concentration, and FAP has an excellent one.
And there was a challenge involved in FAP, right? As Jack alluded to, there were a lot of very beautiful imaging agents that were generated, but not really any therapeutics that had any real legs to them. And on top of our diagnostic program, we really were in parallel looking at how to create the structure required for that retention. And that really put us in a very good position for our therapeutic candidate. But in a general sense, if you look at the Pluvicto data, if you look at the Lutathera data, there's always room for improvement in these therapeutics, right? The first drug that comes out in any space is breaking new ground and is typically, you know, meeting an unmet clinical need. But soon you learn about that drug and you learn about what was sort of left on the table in terms of applications that could maybe improve the therapeutic value of those drugs. And so, as I explained, Trillium, there is a value in actually looking at things from the point of view of best in class, not just first in class. And I think we have that philosophy that, you know, if there are reasons to move into a space that's crowded, we'd have to create a data set that would convince us to do so. But if we do so, the data set, as Jack said, very rational. We're not emotional about this. We would either have the data to support that this would be an improvement over conventional or current therapies or not. And so I think we have to think about this field. You know, Big Pharma is jumping in now, but Big Pharma was never in this field. It was really driven by academic research. And academic research, by definition, is limited because of the financial limitations on academic research laboratories. So when you look at an opportunity, you have the opportunity at least to explore whether or not you can treat it. And I think that's really important. So we're very interested in new targets as well as fine-tuning and optimizing and bringing best-in-class opportunities forward.
So, John, in terms of looking at what's left on the table, there's lots left in case of several new modalities. And a few companies are pursuing radiopharmaceuticals with other therapies. So is there merit in combining, say, things like radiopharmaceuticals and immune checkpoint inhibitors or PARP inhibitors? We've seen some trials which have not really worked with Lynparza, but do you think this merits attention?
I think it merits a lot of attention. And like most therapeutics in cancer, or most patients will see cocktails, right? They'll see a combination of therapies. I can't think of any particular disease that is only ever treated with one drug. And so, you know, the nature of cancer is it's constantly mutating. It's heterogeneous at presentation. So in order to think about adding radiopharmaceuticals to therapeutic armamentarium, I think it's really important that we start to explore the application of targeted radiotherapeutics with other drugs, whether it be PARP inhibitors, DNA PK inhibitors, immune checkpoints. Those are all very obvious because of the radiation and then, of course, the hot topic of immuno-oncology. But I think it goes beyond that to even combinations of therapeutics that are just mechanistically somewhat orthogonal to what radiation is doing to the cell. So you want to weaken the cell in as many the cancer cell in as many places as possible to overcome it. And I think radiation is one aspect of that. Radiation also could enhance the host response. And so lots of people in academic labs and now in corporate sponsored trials are looking at sensitizers such as PARP and other things, but also the application of immune checkpoint inhibitors. So I think it's early in that investigation, and I think it's complicated. So timing is important. Dose is important. Overdosing radiation might be an important thing to consider as well as underdosing. So very, very important for us to sort of explore that and not give up early.
Yeah, I'll just piggyback and say Novartis is really driving the field from a clinical trial environment, and prospective clinical trials have been limited to date in this space, to John's commentary around academia now shifting to great pharma companies. And Recently, a combination enzalutamide PSMA study had massive complete response. I think it was 38% in stage 4 castration-resistant prostate cancer patients. And whether that's amplifying the expression of PSMA in the tumor, people are going to look at other combinations too, not just combining efficacy, but are there going to be drugs that radiation sensitizers, are there going to be drugs that amplify the expression of the antigen? People are working on that both in somatostatin and PSMA. And it's time will tell, but certainly we conclude, Viva, that the market is very excited about the opportunity of combining, to your question, checkpoint inhibitors and radiopharmaceuticals, because by and large, most radiopharmaceuticals have very nominal side effects. Pluvicto, most people on Pluvicto would feel like people were asking if they got the placebo. There, of course, can be toxicities, but by and large, unlike many cancer treatments, the safety profile of these drugs, somewhat counterintuitive, because we're talking about how tough these radionuclides can be, but given the profiles of the drugs in the tumor and then typically excreted renally quickly, it's an exciting time. There's certainly a lot of enthusiasm. I was just at the IO 360 conference in New York, and the excitement about the future and getting real studies, real data in this space, the excitement was palpable. That's for sure.
Yeah, and I think Jack's point is a good one about toxicity. If you can go into a patient, a treatment scenario with non-overlapping toxicity, then you have the opportunity to really try to optimize multiple therapeutics. And this is also an important part of understanding radiopharmaceutical therapies.
We've spoken about other combinations. Let's speak about combining beta and alpha emitting isotopes. For example, we earlier spoke about lutetium and actinium. Given the increasing interest in this combination, I just wanted to get what's your take on this?
So I think it's academically very interesting. So an alpha particle is very, very potent. It does a lot of damage in a very short path length, you know, maybe 5-10 cells. Beta particles have less damage per emission, but they can travel a lot farther. So they can hit other cells in the neighborhood. And so you can contemplate that a combination, a cocktail of alphas and betas might actually be very beneficial depending on the target you go after and depending on the tumor you're going after. You know, it's a little complicated to do that on a corporate level because you have, you know, industrial level, you'd have to have two very well-defined products to get into the clinic. But I think it's something that will eventually show up in clinical trials, if not funded by Big Pharma, certainly funded by, you know, NCI and the like.
Yeah, Viva, there's plenty of theories right now, but in practice, we have to make these measurements. And so, you know, we already measure, our field really looks at grays, absorbed dose, joules per kilogram, just as external beam radiation does. And if you just look at the joules alone for the different isotopes, the alpha emitters are on average 5 times more effective. But that's kind of a conventional wisdom. We study that in mice and so on. Over time, we'll really understand the relative biological effectiveness. That's the quanta that we're trying to seek. And we will, with time and prospective trials, we'll learn what is the RBE in this space. And it's an exciting time for that as well. We also, different isotopes decay at faster rates, so that the rate at which radioactivity is imparted to the tissue. So there's just a lot of unknowns at this time. Over time, over the next decade, we'll shed a lot more light on them with real data instead of less anecdotal or very small studies.
So there's a lot of complexity, as both of you have pointed out, and a lot of theories going around. This is the exact kind of environment that artificial intelligence could play a role in. For example, Merck is trying to use that in developing ADCs. What kind of a role do you see for AI in this area and at Ratio in particular?
John, as a mathematician, I'll take this one.
Yeah, so please.
You know, having in my lifetime, in a previous life, worked with a lot of machine learning and deep learning algorithms for image processing, and imaging is a big part of radiopharmaceuticals, I think there is, and we use here, and almost everyone in the field now uses AI solutions for segmenting images and characterizing biodistribution of drugs in these PET CT scans. We see great hope in the future of medicinal chemistry optimization. That's another great space for AI. So one must approach it from a task-based perspective. In terms of characterizing with a all-encompassing deep learning strategy around systems biology and radiopharmaceuticals, I would be very suspicious that that would be helpful. We have good mechanistic models, pharmacokinetics, and therefore we know the driving parameters, and we study that in great depth. I think that MedChem and data image processing are, to us, the places we as a company look to AI as either just as an accelerating technology or supplementary to our observations. But I don't think it's a catch-all solution.
Right. Given the complexity, you know, the more complex the product is, the more expensive it eventually turns out to be for the customer or the consumer. Access to advanced radiopharmaceutical therapies, similarly, may be limited due to cost and reimbursement policies. Is there a conscious move to ensure greater affordability right from the word go, or you will kind of cross the bridge when you come to it?
I think there's always problems with many types of drugs, getting them globally distributed. And I think when we look at the landscape of radiopharmaceuticals, we would neither consider them the most expensive nor the cheapest class of drugs from a production perspective. If we look at radiopharmaceuticals that are used on a daily basis for diagnosis in cardiac stress tests, bone scans, they're actually incredibly cheap. I actually think they're too cheap. I joke that for me to order dinner on DoorDash is more expensive than to order a technetium cardiolite. For our stage of company, we're really laser focused on getting single agent efficacy and then expanding to all the other nice conversations we had about applications of these drugs. But I don't know that radiopharmaceuticals will end up being overly expensive right now because there's just been a massive movement in the space. There's the world is overcoming supply chain issues and production issues. But longer term, I wouldn't consider this an exceptionally expensive class of drug at all compared to many of the treatment strategies we're seeing in gene therapy and other approaches, for example.
Mm-hmm.
I think time will tell how easy it is to distribute these internationally. That's certainly, they're decaying. So you have a timestamp. John likes to say you're making and shipping ice cream without a freezer. And that's I love that. But I think, you know, actinium, for example, with a 10-day half-life and a longer shelf life product, that there's also lots of other therapies that can be very challenging from a manufacturing perspective. Yeah. I think we're probably in the middle.
Yeah, and I think you hit it right now. The field is gearing up. And so as things are scarce, things are very expensive, right? If you have one supplier, things are expensive. And I think you realize that as the infrastructure grows, the cost will likely come down. You know, this is not going to be the most expensive, nor will it be the cheapest. But there is an inherent requirement of quality and a fairly complex infrastructure, A, to make radionuclides and also to make the finished radiopharmaceutical product. So in a way, this is not dealt with easily by scaling, right? So if you said, listen, I'm going to make a drug, say doxorubicin for lack of a better name, you know, and you could make hundreds of kilograms of that in a plant and store it, that's a very different situation than making, say, Pluvicto on literally a weekly, if or maybe multiple times a week, because of this sort of melting ice cream phenomenon, right? So there is a requirement to be making these batches of drugs on a regular basis that's not typical in a conventional pharmaceutical. Although now we get into CAR T cells and you get into other, you know, complicated therapies, even antibody drug conjugates, you know, that's a very expensive play as well because of the protein engineering and the protein conjugation, the purification. So, you know, we're entering areas in cancer therapy where the solutions are becoming complicated, not because we want them to be, but it seems simple solutions aren't the answer. And so I think we'll see this evolve and mature, and that'll drive the cost down.
I like that analogy of, you know, ice cream melting, because as you rightly pointed out, this is one of the things that happened with Pluvicto, and there was a shortage of the drug. So Ratio has a tie-up with PharmaLogic for manufacturing. How critical do you think in-house manufacturing is going to be in the long term for companies such as yourself and for Novartis? Perhaps to a lesser extent, but more for emerging biotechs, because you can't have a huge manufacturing facility and tie-ups with companies like PharmaLogic become critical. So if you could just talk a bit more about how you think the supply could expand and how the manufacturing could develop in the future.
You You know, PharmaLogic is an incredibly attractive partner for us. They are nationally located. They have a pharmacy distribution network, on top of which they have a manufacturing, you know, CFR 11 compliant manufacturing capabilities that they're building out. This is unique. If we were to invest in a single plant, you know, we'd have a fraction of what PharmaLogic has, or say Cardinal would have, right? So I think we need the PharmaLogics of the world to actually improve the infrastructure for the whole field. And it's critical for us to be associated with such a high quality place.
Yeah, there's a plane. I can see Logan out my window. There's some of that melting ice cream lutetium coming in from Western Europe. I agree with what John said. I think we looked at building out a facility versus doing a strategic alliance and a strategic partnership. And frankly, given PharmaLogic's infrastructure and the network they've built, you know, building a single site, Viva, as your listeners will know, all business decisions are make, buy, and partner. And partner here was absolutely the best decision for our company near and long term. And we also see great long term, back to the cost in the future, the amount of capital that's gone into the production of radioisotopes for medical use over the last 5-7 years is, we're always stressed out. That's what we should be, but we're also very bullish on the outlook of radionuclide supply and manufacturing in this market.
That's great. So in kind of a 360 degree way, let's come back to the funding bit. You now have over $90 million in funding, right? So do any of the investing biotech companies like BMS have agreements for milestone payments or for future preferential share allotments?
BMS was an investor in the Series B. Bayer, Merck, and Lantheus are not equity shareholders of the company. There are milestone payments. We in-licensed the Merck asset, so there's downstream partnership there. There's downstream partnership with Lantheus in the case where we out-licensed our asset. And we've worked with Bayer on the PSMA program, and for all intents and purposes, that partnership is complete and was successful. They announced that they've opened up a clinical trial for the PSMA therapeutic we developed for them. So by and large, no, the company stands on its own merits, and certainly for the FAP therapeutic, it's exclusively a ratio product.
Right. But for any emerging biotech, the ultimate aim is to be acquired by a biotech. So I don't know if...
So I would say that it's possible in this space to develop a drug and take it to commercial asset. So the only exit is not that of acquisition. But either way, we have a great shareholder base and a good organization, and we're moving it forward. We don't have any strings attached, so to speak, to our business.
Okay, so I have one last question, which is there anything else you would like to talk about, you know, as founders and as people who have set up this company, which has very exciting prospects ahead of it? Is there something else you would like to share with our listeners?
No, I think this has been very thorough. I appreciated your time, and I think our enthusiasm about the outlook of our company and the market in general, and this extending life and maintaining quality, but that's why we come to work every day.
I would agree, Viva. I think, you know, the excitement around the field is palpable. It's real. And as Jack said, you know, extending life for cancer patients while allowing them to have a quality of life is really crucial. And it's one of our main objectives every day.
It was great talking to the both of you. And I thank you both for being on this call, Jack and John. That kind of leads me to a nursery rhyme, but I won't go there.
But you can just call us J&J.
Thank you, Viva. Yeah. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Thanks. I hope our listeners found the conversation as interesting as I did. We have many such podcasts, so don't forget to check out the Sightline channel and subscribe on platforms like Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Thanks for listening, and bye for now.